live show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show, and I'm also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, which helps those with cancer to learn about how to use integrative medicine to improve their quality of life and extend their lives. My guest this week is Dawn Wooldrum, someone who's been working in this space for at least as long as Yes to Life's been around, and who has become a regular guest on this show with her knack of explaining complex biochemistry and her deeply inquisitive nature that continually draws her forward on a journey of personal investigation of health and well-being. Hi Dawn, brilliant to have you back as my guest today.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Always good to talk to you, and lovely to be on this gorgeous autumn morning here.
I love our chats. They're always really informative. So you're what I call a born explorer. You're always throwing light on new ideas, angles, possibilities. Love it. So today we're going to be speaking about one of your current interests, medicinal mushrooms. It's a great topic in my book. I'm a fully signed up mushroom fad, and I have been right since the dawning of Yes to Life. But before we dive in, for those of you who don't know you, and there must be some out there.
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell them what you do and how you got here?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Robin. Yeah. Short version. I was diagnosed with stage 3, grade 3, triple negative breast cancer when I was 33. So I always say 3 is not my lucky number.
All the 3.
miraculously, that was almost 30 years ago. And, you know, there aren't many people lucky enough to be sitting here talking to you 30 years after a diagnosis like that. So I'm grateful for every day. But what it did when I was diagnosed, I had the strongest sense in my life that I really did need to sort some stuff out. And while I had the most lovely surgeon, just the most lovely man in Tim Williams, and fabulous oncologist David Pickering, I really knew at the deepest level that I needed to do more. And I knew that my mind and body had been telling me that for quite a long time. And back then there wasn't much more. And there was, of course, can you imagine pre-Google?
Right.
And there was the Bristol Cancer Centre, now Penny Bron. And I so vividly remember they sent me, I wrote off to them, and they sent me, I think, four or five sheets of what at the time was the peak of marketing excellence, which was they were all printed on different coloured paper, run off on a duplicating machine or a photocopier, with some top tips, you know, meditation, maybe think about taking some vitamin C, et cetera, et cetera. And that was all I could find. I felt that so deeply, and we've discussed this before, Robin. I felt like an outlier, a bit of a weirdo, and my friends definitely, bless them, struggled with my intuitions and my feelings around nutrition and the importance of changing my life. But any other belief, of course, would be that really I'd just received a death sentence.
Right. Yeah.
And so so I had to find something else. And because there wasn't anything, after I got through my treatment, so chemotherapy, radiotherapy, they really threw the book at me. I had radiotherapy burns and the chemo was really grueling. But then after that, I sort of bounced back, had some cranial osteopathy. One thing led to another. This particular osteopath mentioned some nutritional things I could do, and it sort of just unraveled, and I started to explore, as I've always done. I ended up enrolling with ION, the Institute for Optimum Nutrition, funny enough, reprising my A-levels doing the Science Foundation, which this time around I absolutely loved. I hated my A-levels. I hated
funny,
studying science.
How you revisit these things, you think, actually, this is really interesting.
Yes. Yeah, I think because it was about me by then, or just because I had inspirational teachers and I had enough life under my belt to realize how important these sciences are. And so I did that. And then I studied with ION for 3 years and found Oh, I don't know. Is it a coincidence, Robin? I learned about this, but I also found my purpose and my passion, which of course is another way that my body sort of lit up and my brain.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a coincidence
Very
either.
Important. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was me.
Very good. And now?
And now, I guess, 20 years of clinical practice, quite a lot of lecturing and teaching along the way. And then when I hit my 60th birthday, I decided that I couldn't hold space for people one-to-one anymore. It wasn't that I cared less. It was more that I had started to care more and more for each patient that came along. And I was finding it harder to be detached. And so I thought, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, week in, week out, very full diary by that time. Most patients who were coming to me were stage four. And I thought, there was a certain inefficiency. I was repeating myself so many times to each person, one-on-one. And then a bit of frustration that all the time I spent, and there was a lot of time creating notes for each individual client, there was so much research building up that I never got time to look at. So I decided to take my one-on-one work and transform it into one-to-many. I thought that was the beginning of semi-retirement. And that turns out I was very wrong.
Yeah, right.
And things sort of have snowballed from there. And I just so love what I do now, the research and the people I've connected with as a result, and a feeling of perhaps helping more people. And increasingly now my focus is on helping practitioners to make more people available to help more people. And next year I'm hoping to launch a BANT course, an accredited BANT course, which will be CPD, to work with practitioners. So
great stuff.
That sort of brings me up to date.
Yeah, so it's actually the beginning of a new career, not the beginning of retirement. And yeah, interesting. You've taken that move, which, you know, people often do, of going up a layer, if you like, going from the one-to-one to the one-to-many, of actually helping practitioners to help more people. And it's an important part of life, it feels, to pass on your experience and knowledge to another generation, not to just retire from doing one-to-one, you know, all of a sudden.
I think that's so true. I think that's true. And also, one of the things I learned in the last sort of 5 years of my practice was how expert patients are becoming.
Yeah, you're right.
They're so educated. And so consequently, that I always see my Substack blog as for what I call specialist practitioners and expert patients. Because people are more than happy to get very, very much involved in saving their own lives.
Yes.
And that they'll learn a lot to try to do that. And I want to support that journey.
Very motivating. Yeah. And coming back to the threes, what have you got planned for 33 years after your diagnosis?
Well, fun. Yes, you've really tuned into something there, because I will be 66.
Right.
And that's been a sort of little beacon on my horizon for a while. So unlike a lot of people, I did my 60th fairly low key.
Right.
And I'm not really a party person. I love people, and I really enjoyed our awards party in the summer, Robin. But more and more I like thoughtful connection with people. So I don't know what I will do. But for me, 66 is so meaningful. I can remember asking my surgeon, actually while he was taking my stitches out, whether I'd make my 50th birthday. And he was a little bit careful with his words at that point.
I can imagine.
And he said, if you do, he said, I'm coming to the party.
That's good.
Yeah. And the idea of making it to 66, which I think is pretty likely now. I've never taken it for granted since then. But I'm hoping being careful crossing the road and everything. To make it to 66.
Yeah,
for celebration.
You've got a good chance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now back to the topic of the day. Medicinal mushrooms.
Yeah.
How did you get into this one?
Well, funny enough, this is another link to ION, where I studied. The very lovely Dr. Heather Rosa, who's the dean, and ION have just actually won an award for higher education, their contribution to higher education, which is lovely to see. And Heather Rosa reached out to me and she said, do you fancy doing a talk at our networking evening in November on mycology? So I was probably quite distracted at times. And yeah, sure. Fine, Heather, no problem.
No problem.
Typical. I must learn to stop doing that. Yes, fine. And so that was that. Then I saw her again at the amazing IPM Congress and at the Westminster reception evening in June, where it was lovely to bump into a lot of people. And she said, "You're still on for that?" I said, "Yes, no problem. Mycology, right?" She said, yes, mycology. Anyway, so because as you know, but maybe not everybody else does, my interest is very much in the mitochondria. So on the basis that if cancer is indeed a metabolic disease, which we're pretty sure it is, at least it is in large part a metabolic disease, then everything that works for cancer has to have some impact on the mitochondria, really.
Right.
And everything that might cause cancer has to have some impact on the mitochondria. So that's where I'm coming from. You might call it a belief system in some ways, but I think it's fairly well supported. So I was immediately thinking mycology, fungus, what negative impact does fungus have on the different enzymes in the mitochondrial, in the electron transport chain, for example. So that's where my mind was going, complex one inhibitors and stuff like that. So that's great. And then a couple of weeks later, I saw at the beginning of ION's marketing blurb for the night come up on Instagram, my face,
right,
the power of medicinal mushrooms. I didn't realize I'd agreed to speak about that. So I reached out to Heather, and actually, as a result of that conversation, we brought Kirsten Chick in, who did an amazing talk about mushrooms on the same evening. And I actually said to Heather, "I think you've got the wrong speaker, Heather, because medicinal mushrooms are not really my thing." And when I was in practice, I used to delegate that. I used to actually ask Kifasta Terra to look at protocols for people that were more specific than my knowledge base would allow. I guess I've always seen mushrooms as almost like a life's work in themselves. They're so complicated. They're so amazing.
It's unusual that one bunch of plant species in this way gets their own ology. How many other species have got an ology?
Yes, broccolology. That should be one, I think.
Yeah, so it is very specialised. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. And also this sense of, there's a funny sense of sort of treading on hallowed ground a bit,
Right.
And not wanting to oversimplify, I guess, because they are complicated. And they sort of sit somewhere between the animal and plant kingdom as well. So, a lot to take on board. So anyway, I agreed in the end. I think my arm was firmly up my back at the point. And I thought, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I have to speak about this from a mitochondrial perspective. And once I started looking at the literature, I found papers on the genetic effects of mushrooms. That's fairly well documented.
Yes.
And then there were some papers on the gut microbial effect of mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
Quite a lot of cell studies, quite a few mouse studies, very few human studies. But no one had done a review on where mushrooms might be having an effect in the mitochondria. So I thought, okay, well, I've got to start from scratch here.
That's your thing. Yeah, right.
And so that's what I did. I sort of started. I think I probably did a lot more worrying for the first few weeks than,
yeah,
than
right.
researching. Yeah. And then finally got stuck into it.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Look, a couple of things, if we could touch on them quickly, just before we get into what you actually found. One of them is that, as I said at the beginning, there was a mountain of evidence 20 years ago. Well, there's an overwhelming mountain of evidence by now, I'm sure. What are the headlines of what it says about mushrooms and cancer? What can they do?
So there's all sorts of things. So they help with fatigue. They help with digestion and gut issues. They can help to support your immune system. There's a long list, really, of the benefits of mushroom stamina. We do have to be a little bit careful, and I really need to emphasize this, that different mushrooms have different effects.
Right.
Some of them are slightly hormonal. And so if you want to use mushrooms as part of a treatment or even a recovery protocol, it really does make sense to get some expert advice. Don't just go out and buy a mixed mushroom powder, which are widely available because of the different benefits of different mushrooms. You often find that mushrooms are mixed in, you know, three different types and that sort of thing, but really get some help. So they can be quite specific. You know, there are things, if you've got prostate cancer, you should avoid, or breast cancer.
Right.
So again, it's an area where expertise is valuable. Tom Baxter, who grows mushrooms in England, and I can't even begin to describe Tom's knowledge and presence around this area.
Right.
But he's the Bristol Fungarium is a very good place to start if you're looking for help with mushrooms.
Mm. Okay, so the summary is they're enormously helpful. And, you know, this is something, as you say, has been capitalized on in some countries, unfortunately, not the UK, of course.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to just have a quickly touch on is eukaryotic cells. So this, I didn't know about eukaryotic cells until a few years back. And when I did find out about it, it was a slightly sort of light bulb moment. in as much as I, you know, I've taken note of how extraordinarily helpful and harmful fungi could be to humans. And this is like, well, okay, there is this commonality which sort of explains that. Do you want to just say a word or two about that?
So one of the things that was interesting in my research, and one of the things that made my research more difficult, Robin, is actually when I started to look at the mitochondrial aspects of this, I had to be quite vigilant about whether I was looking at chemicals that were helpful for mushrooms or chemicals that were helpful for humans.
Right.
Because they work quite similarly. So mushrooms have a sort of electron transport chain similar to us. So they work, they respire and they metabolize quite similarly because of their complex cellular nature. So yes, if that's what you mean, there's this strange crossover. And one of the things I found in my research, for example, is that it's a little bit technical, but at the beginning of our electron transport chain, which, to remind people, is the way we make energy. So we process protons and electrons through the electron transport chain in order to extract energy from food, if you like. And at the start of this chain, there is a what we call complex one, the NADH dehydrogenase enzyme, which generates, it takes NADH derived from our food and it turns it into NAD plus, which is a buzz nutrient at the moment. Don't take it. In the process, it frees protons and electrons to go through the chain. And this is where I started with being interested in the mycology side, that some fungal infections might depress the activity of this enzyme, which is a big deal for humans. If complex one is affected, that does significantly increase your risk of cancer. But when I started looking at medicinal mushrooms, what I found is that mushrooms carry alternative enzymes that act in a very similar way that can also take NADH and turn it into NAD plus. So in that very specialist way, they may be able to augment the activity of complex one or make up for damaged complex one. And that's quite possibly, hypothetically, no studies, no human studies in this, one of the ways they work for us to keep supporting respiration and the forward movement of protons and electrons, because it's when that process gets stuck, normally around complex two, the next one in the chain, that the cell can go into reverse and start to go into growth mode and biosynthesis. So anything that helps to keep the movement going forward down the chain of electrons is helping us to avoid cancer. So I find that fascinating. The fact that they might have some enzymes which are similar to human enzymes and can help us with respiration. And that is one of the most interesting things I discovered as part of looking into this. And I guess gave me a new respect and a new understanding of where mushrooms fit in.
Mm. So it sounds like there's a lot more to be found out about our fungal friends.
Yes, and a lot more looking to do, because, you know, what was absolutely clear about my search of the literature is that it's just not there. It's just not being looked at from this perspective properly.
Right.
And yet there are so many clues that mushrooms actually really shift metabolism, and they shift us into this AMPK state, and they activate some of our genes that are associated with what listeners might be more familiar with, this idea of how the ketogenic diet works, how the fasting works, those sort of how heat shock therapies work. It looks as though mushrooms work on the same pathways and can augment that fasting state metabolism and put us into AMPK mode or help with that.
Amazing. All right. Well, look, so this is kind of how you made sense of your ask from Heather Rosa to start presenting on mushrooms. You thought, well, I'm not going to talk about mushrooms from the regular perspective because that's been done. It's not your area. But you're going to move the spotlight. You're going to take the genetic spotlight that's been on them for years and you're going to move it underneath the metabolic spotlight and just see what you can find. And
absolutely,
the answer was not much. But yeah, nonetheless, you have found some things and you've drawn some conclusions from what you've found. And so, you know, this is very interesting. So maybe you've spoken in previous interviews we've done about this energy cycle and how trying to keep promoting forward movement in this way and avoid the kind of reversal that you were just describing. You know, this is clearly something which can be helpful with this important task. So maybe you want to say a bit more now about what you found about the ways in which medicinal mushrooms can help with our metabolics.
Sure. Thanks, Robin. Yes, happy to touch on that. I guess one of the basic things to establish is that the biochemistry in our mitochondria, of which there are hundreds in most of our cells, or thousands even, it depends on tiny, tiny ratios. You know, it's all held in a very fine balance.
Okay.
So sometimes one of the things I think we sort of gloss over or miss when we're talking about cancer is that even, you know, because we're used to tackling cancer with nuclear medicine and things like that, I think there's often an assumption, and I think not unfair to say that, particularly within medical circles, that if the big guns can't touch it, what can little things do, sort of thing.
That's right. I know. Big mistake, that one, eh?
Absolutely. And it is actually in the fine balance that we can persuade the cells to, you know, what I'm increasingly fascinated by is the possibility that we may be able to rehabilitate cancer cells, that we may actually, now that we understand that, I'm not going to say it's simple, but that nevertheless, cancer cells that are sort of moving forward to make energy can turn round and move backwards to make growth, if you like, then my mind, along with a lot of researchers, is going towards, well, if it can be turned around once, it can be turned back again. And that's where I'm starting to see, as my research, I started to see mushrooms as helpers along that way.
Right.
So little sort of levers. So, okay, we can add a bit of help here. So if you're trying to re-educate the cell to go back to its old, its former mature differentiated behavior, then mushrooms are almost like metabolic trainers, just easing things along.
Right.
So helping to improve the conversion of NADH to NAD+, as I've mentioned, supporting uncoupling, which I've talked about before with you, I know, which is where we...
Yes.
So where cancer cells, you know, where the rubber hits the road with cancer cells, I've already talked about the fact that the electron transport chain stops moving forwards. And if anything stops moving in the electron transport chain, you get this buildup of protons that is potentially explosive. Your mitochondria may well blow up along with the cell at that point. And so the body has several different mechanisms to protect us from that. And, you know, in some ways, I'm starting to see all the other pathologies like obesity and diabetes as part of that protective chain. Let's keep the sugar away from the mitochondria. Let's store it. Let's pool it in the blood because it's better than trying to pool it in the mitochondria, which will lead to disaster. So there's all that sort of thing going on in order to stop this proton buildup in the mitochondria, which is certain death.
Right.
Uncoupling is one of those protection mechanisms where we can let off steam, we can let protons out of that space where they form heat rather than energy, and therefore we can let it go safely, even if you're sitting on a sofa. Because one of the problems is, of course, we're designed to make energy, and the food that we eat is designed to be turned into energy. But if you're not moving, if there is no activity either in your brain or your body or whatever, then that proton motive force is likely to be building up. So uncoupling can sort of, you know, one of the reasons you get hot after eating.
Right.
You know.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Can I just underline something you were saying a minute ago? Because I just think it's so important, which is this kind of directionality. And you're talking about it on a cellular level. I talk about it on a level of cancer. And cancer has been sold to the public as having sort of been unidirectional. You get it and it gets bigger, worse, takes over, and then it kills you. And your only chance of changing that is if you use, it's interesting they use this word in cancer care, the nuclear option, which is you get in there and you do something so drastic it cuts it off dead, every single cell right now, and then you might save your life. That's kind of how it's been sold to the public.
Absolutely.
And it's not like that. I know it's not like that. Just from experience is that cancer goes up and it goes down. It has momentum and sometimes it gains momentum and it needs something to bring it back and to check. And it can then go down again.
Absolutely.
Actually lose momentum, even to having no momentum. And so it's a completely different way of relating to cancer and to how we look at treating cancer as well. As you say, that mistake of thinking it only works if you get the big guns on it because it's a very serious disease, I think is wrong.
Yes.
And we need to bring in this thinking more about the fact we're trying to get our systems to regulate and go in the right direction again, just maintain its healthy homeostasis, go back to where it should be. So anyway, I just wanted to get in there and underline that point.
No, you're so right, Robin. And actually, to underline that point, when I first started practicing in 2003, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, was also on the books as irreversible.
Yes.
And we weren't allowed to take on patients who had diabetes, particularly not type 1, but we were advised not to take on type 2 as well. We weren't allowed to advertise in any way that we could support people with diabetes. And it was on your records as an irreversible disease. And of course, we know that's not true.
Right.
There can't be many people that think it's irreversible anymore.
Hopefully.
And I think we will go that way with cancer too. I'm not saying we understand it, but there are enough instances of people going into remission without treatment, and there's enough understanding of the peaks and flows of people's cancer journeys to understand that the body does have its own mechanisms. And I have a lot of faith that we will eventually understand that. And I also have no doubt that the answer will, to a large extent, rely on our reconnection with nature.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and all this stuff about chronobiology now, there are some interesting things about mushrooms in chronobiology.
Right.
But this idea about getting outside, you know, gardening, walking in nature, breathing fresh air. We had a weekend away with our daughter a couple of weeks ago in Broadstairs, and we had a lovely time. But driving back, we dropped her off at Margate station to go back into London. And on the way out, I passed the Margate Hospital for Marine Air or something like that, or marine bathing.
Oh, really?
And I looked it all up.
Yeah.
And before the discovery of DNA, really, it was one of the preeminent hospitals.
Right.
This understanding that, you know, sea bathing, the sea air was so important for restoration. It was very important in treating tuberculosis.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, in came technical medicine, and we dismissed it all as though it's sort of like just folklore. But it is not. This, you know, we evolved on the planet. We evolved on the planet, you know, before we had vinyl flooring.
Mm. We, right.
We lived on the earth, in the earth, in nature.
Yeah.
And for the vast majority of our development as a species, we have been inextricably connected with nature, which has carried some major risks. And in trying to eradicate all of those risks, we, in the last 100 years, say, we have lost something truly fundamental to human thriving. And we have to get it back.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah, the whole sort of, you know, traditional idea that for a lot of diseases, the best thing you could do is to go to sort of health spa in a very different climate or whatever. It was really founded on something, and I got a personal experience of that this year, because I went off to walk the Camino, 240 kilometres, with a healthy dose of at least flu, if not COVID, and I thought, how on earth am I going to do this? And the climate was actually very good. The sun was out. It was very nice all the time, and I just set out, and I got walking, which meant, of course, I was breathing like mad. I was exercising, moving my whole body. Well, you know, it went away in less than 2 days.
Wow. Yeah.
Extraordinary. The flu doesn't do that.
No, it
doesn't.
You know,
you have to sit through it.
And yeah, you go to bed and you dose yourself up and you draw the curtains and you know, that's the way we do it, isn't it? Have a rest. I'm not saying don't rest if you're ill, but it is quite interesting, isn't it? This idea that if you trust your body to keep going and you get out in nature, that you might have a different outcome.
Mm.
It's so important. But sort of where were we? We were
back to the biochemistry. Yes. Okay.
lots of lovely tangents, though, Robin. I'm not complaining.
Can I ask you a question? Look, you've done this exercise in your style of like trying something new, and you've thrown this new metabolic light on medicinal mushrooms. So the thing is, from the patient point of view, do you think this tells us anything new about how we can best use them to help people with cancer? Or do you think it will tell us that in time?
I think it's a pretty new idea that mushrooms can actually support metabolism. So if you are, for example, if you're trying a ketogenic diet or if you're trying fasting, the idea that mushrooms can support your mitochondria to move in the right direction, I think is I don't think we would previously have thought of mushrooms specifically for that. Except, of course, we do talk about mushrooms for energy and stamina.
Right.
And this is probably where those two ideas intersect. What I did, because I love you know, one of the things I most love doing is trying to communicate things in a way that makes such a deeply technical subject more accessible. And while I was pulling this all together and I was searching for, so I have this model of flux in the mitochondria where there are about sort of 20 different areas where when I'm looking at a remedy, be it broccoli or mushrooms or NAD+, I'm saying, which of these mechanisms might this be supporting, you know? And it's a pretty picture called balancing flux. But when I was looking at the mushrooms thing, I was thinking, okay, I need to find a couple of areas where mushrooms influence flux very specifically. And I thought I'd be lucky to find a couple. But in actual fact, by the end of my research, we played a game in the talk at ION, which is based on the idea of pin the tail on the donkey. I was doing pin the mushroom on the mitochondrial mechanism, which is not quite such a catchy title, but you know.
No.
But the thing is, when I looked at the various areas I've identified that really help to keep flux moving in the right direction, mushrooms were there helping with 10, 12, 13 of them.
Wow.
You know, not so that's partly why it's very hard for me to say, oh, this is what mushrooms do, because they clearly help in lots of different ways at a mitochondrial level. So that's the science, that's the biochemistry. Of course, we are lacking the human trials to say, oh, they definitely do this. But at a biochemical level and an understanding of human biology, it is entirely understandable that they will. And they, for example, help. So another concept that people are not necessarily very familiar with that I wish they were more familiar with is this idea of the oncometabolite. So we know about oncogenes. Everybody knows about oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. It's sort of in the language now, particularly if you've had a diagnosis. But as part of accepting and integrating the metabolic approach, the fact that there are very well, unquestionably identified oncometabolites, where when their ratios shift in the body, we know that you're predisposed to cancer or cancer might be being more active, etc., is a bit of an underexplored idea. And yet that's precisely what we're normally measuring when we're looking at tumor markers and things like that.
Right.
So things like lactate, you know, lactate is an oncometabolite.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with lactate, but we need to, in fact, it can be very useful and it helps us manage our glucose levels, but we need it not to build up. So with all these things, it's not that they're intrinsically bad, but we need them to stay within their ratios. And so
keep the system moving.
Absolutely. And so we've got oncometabolites like succinate, fumarate, lactate, etc., that when they build up in the mitochondria, they are sending out messages. They are causing epigenetic changes. And actually, this is perhaps the more exciting area where cancer might be described as a genetic disease, as an epigenetic disease. And it's the metabolites that are actually shifting. They're causing the non-mutational epigenetic reprogramming that has recently been admitted into the Cancer Hallmarks sort of Hall of Fame, if you like.
Yeah.
So that's metabolic in origin. It's not genetic in origin.
Fascinating. You know what, Dawn? We're out of time. That was amazing.
I can't believe it.
It's whizzed away. Look, I think that it's very interesting, your exploration. You know, I say I'm a massive mushroom fan, but as you point out, there's probably a lot more to know about it. And with the rise of metabolic science and the appreciation of cancer as a metabolic disease, their role in helping us may grow enormously, even though they're already recognized to be exceptionally helpful.
I think so.
So I think it's very good that you're pushing the boundaries a bit here and wanting people to explore mushrooms and what they do for us in a new way. So another amazing dive into metabolics. Thank you, Dawn. The only person I know who's capable of making biochemistry both accessible and hilarious.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks so much. Yeah, let's not leave it too long till the next exploration.
Always lovely to talk to you. Bye, Robin.
Bye-bye. Bye. That last comment of mine was completely true. And if you don't believe me, you should go to one of Dawn's lectures yourself. You'll come away having learnt a lot, as well as being thoroughly entertained. The Yes to Life Stockings of Hope Christmas campaign is well underway for a second year. And as well as providing a way for you to support the work of the charity at this time, there's a whole raft of free resources on offer for those with cancer to help them through Christmas, a time which many love, but one that can be a difficult one if you have cancer, or indeed if one of your family or close friends has cancer. It's well worth a look. Go to stockingsofhope.org. And once you've had a look, do please spread the word amongst friends and colleagues. This would mean an awful lot to us. Many thanks for listening. I'll be back at the same time next week with another expert guest and another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.